You are listening to Crime Friction, a podcast about Yeti.
And what to do with them.
Baby Crowder's Road. And so is love. If you do, you either want to be right, you're wearing a glove. Crime Friction.
So this is episode 2 of our crazy stupid adventure.
Because, you know, if at first you don't succeed, quit.
We are glad that you're coming with us on this journey.
Allison won't be happy to hear you say that, Jay.
No, she won't. But that's spoilers.
No, not spoilers.
Also, don't really like New Year's Eve.
Well, here's the bigger problem that I have is the whole, like, Christmas a month following Thanksgiving, let's cook turkey twice type deal, then let's celebrate again.
I suppose, I mean, you know, you've had Thanksgiving over there and you've had Christmas here. It's 2 weeks of
It's an extravaganza of horrors,
family
Jay.
Over and over again. And then, you know, New Year's is the first chance to you can leave your family and go off and just get drunk with strangers in a strange room and let off fireworks.
I call that a Tuesday.
See, I really, really don't like New Year's resolutions because I used to smoke when I was younger. And when I was doing the thing of saying, you know, I'll quit at the end of the packet or I'll quit next month or I'll quit after my birthday, I ended up never quitting. It wasn't until the day when I got halfway down a cigarette and just said, I'm quitting right now. That's when I quit. And New Year's resolutions, it just feels to me like if you're going to save up all of these things that you're going to do at some point in a month's time, it's just like admitting in advance that you're not going to do any of them.
New Year's Eve was never a big thing in my family. I'm often up past midnight, and yet on New Year's Eve, I've rarely seen the ball drop, mostly because somehow I fall asleep before then. I'm a really exciting person who, you know, knits. And yeah, I'm big on spending it on the sofa, not realizing that it's actually a different year. I write checks in the past year for at least a good month or two.
I really don't know how to plan a New Year's Eve party. Do you see what I did there?
I see what you did there.
This is a segue.
I hope I have a riposte in some way.
We're leaving this in. People are going to listen live to us figuring out a segue to a segment. We thought we should put one together, but we have no idea how to go about it. So we sent out our puppy PI Rover reporter to also become a party planner.
This is Dan and Kate Melman, editors for Crime Stream Magazine, reviewers for the Writer Types podcast, and co-editors for the Killing Melman anthology, with all proceeds going to the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. Available now!
So New Year's Eve is always an opportunity to evaluate your life and look for opportunities for improvement. So I had that in mind as I was creating my New Year's Eve guest list. So the first person I'm going to invite to my party is Nora Charles from The Thin Man by Dashiell Hammett. She's going to teach me how to be fancy. I would also invite Mira James from the Murder by Month series by Jess Lowry. She would teach me to keep asking questions. And finally, I would invite Rey from Star Wars. She would teach me how to be fearless.
Now, I was raised on television, so for this New Year's Eve party, I would invite Jonathan and Jennifer Hart from Heart to Heart, Laura Holt and Remington Steele from Remington Steele, and lastly, Dave and Maddie from Moonlighting. But wait a sec, aren't we both going to the same party?
This is Rob Hart, author of The Woman from Prague. So I think I would have to go with Hannibal Lecter, Darth Vader, and Lizzie Borden. I should clarify, my New Year's Eve party is going to be held at the Donald Trump White House at the last minute. I am going to make other plans, and I'm not going to tell them.
Hi, this is Steve Weddle. You may know me from Country Hardball, a novel and stories, or from the November 2015 issue of Playboy. The thing about New Year's Eve, Alfred Watkins, who wrote the Leyline book, The Old Straight Track, back in 1925, would likely be a hoot and a holler on New Year's Eve. Or Henri Bouguer, who wrote An Examen of Witches, would probably have some good stories. But I'd more than likely have to kill him because he was a right bastard. So, thinking about this, I'd want three people who would be fun, entertaining, and get along fine. And once you consider those criteria, it's pretty easy to figure out who you'd want to invite. First and foremost, of course, you'd want Hunter S. Thompson for your New Year's Eve party. He could bring his medical bag. You'd want John of Patmos, the young fellow who was dipped into boiling oil and then exiled to the island of Patmos, where he wrote the book of Revelation. And then you'd want scholar and dreamer Mary Shelley, who is probably one of the brightest folks to have lived in the past few hundred years, and would be a nice, intelligent, smart, scholarly person, but also someone given to flights of fancy and dreaming. So I like to think that by the end of the evening, we'd end up on the roof shooting things at dragons.
Today, we welcome USA Today and international best-selling author Allison Galen. She has received 3 Edgar nominations, an ITW Award nomination, an Anthony Award nomination, and her book, What Remains of Me, has won the Seamus Award and the RT Award for Best Suspense, and was also nominated for a Strand and Edgar Award. Her next book, If I Die Tonight, is a standalone, which will be out in March 2018 from William Morrow. Please find more about her in the show notes.
Oh, no.
I saw an undiscovered creature climbing on the mountainside. You know that no one else believe me. How about that?
I read a news story today that apparently even sharks are freezing to death with climate change. That's...
Oh my God. Well, I'm actually in Vermont right now, and it's like,
oh, you're kidding, where in Vermont?
Woodstock, Vermont, and I'm from Woodstock, New York. So I'm just, my aim is to see every Woodstock in the entire country, which I think there are a lot of them. But it's beautiful here, but it's like 10 degrees colder than it is in Woodstock, New York, which is really super cold. So I'm kind of huddled in a corner of a hotel bar right now doing this interview. But
well, you have half of it right, at least the bar part.
Bar is really, that's very important.
You're on a vacation that you can't go outside. That sounds
exactly
wonderful.
That's the whole point. There's lots of beautiful hiking areas, but you can't step foot in them because
it's shame.
Uninhabitable. You have to stay in the bar the whole time, which is really my favorite kind of vacation anyway. So it's all good.
Right? Great talk. It's nothing wrong with this at all. I don't see why you're complaining, yes. Allison. I don't.
I know. I'm not at all. Believe me.
Can you get a hiking holiday when the barman goes with you?
Oh, see, that would be perfect. Or you can just take the flask to go. Still, you know, I think actually the barman going with you is a lot better. You know, you don't have to worry about mixing the drinks beforehand and, you know.
Yeah, he's got a backpack.
Well, isn't that why they invented St. Bernards?
Yes, exactly. St. Bernards. That's what they were bred for. Like, if that dog couldn't get any more awesome, the fact that it was bred to carry around.
And breeding is the correct word. I don't think they invented St. Bernards.
Yes.
They were bred.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I don't know. There's a lab somewhere where, you know.
Yeah. Let's make the biggest, most adorable dog in the world and let it carry alcohol to you. That's like sort of any fantasy that anybody would come up with.
Exactly.
Very, very worthwhile. I think many a traveler has been lost in the icy wilderness in the hopes that they will be rescued by a St. Bernard.
That's got to be the only reason people try and climb Everest.
I was told there'd be alcohol.
Yes, exactly. Where's my
and
cute
cuddles?
Where's the cute puppy with a keg around its neck? Come on.
Well, there was that fascinating article. I think I sent it to you, Jay, about all of the people who were frozen in situ on Everest. You know, and how they either had the backstory, or they would just be called by like a piece of clothing that was still visible. Like, there's one guy, I think it's like orange boots or yellow boots, and that's all you can see. So as you climb, there are, you know, because they can't bring them down. So half of them, they know who they are. You just pass this essentially frozen graveyard of people who have had accidents.
God, that's horrifying.
Never brought back down.
That's horrifying. I mean, it's the imagery of that too. It's like, you know, just to be identified by that one sort of telltale article of clothing, and you're just there. That's where you're going to be. I mean,
so I guess the moral is, if you're going to climb Everest, take your own grave marker with you. Because
wear something really memorable.
Yeah, then it's all
well,
done.
there's some expedition going on now that's going to go and take a few people back. Like, they're going to take some of the bodies home, you know, after I don't know how long. And I think that one of them, and I don't know if they're taking that one back as well or not, is Hillary. They know where he is. There's some really interesting stories. There's another, and I don't know if it was on Everest or not, but it was a couple who lived just below a mountain that, you know, similar climbable mountain. And one day never came back. They had like a farm and all of this, and they had fairly older children, but they never came home. Eventually, like 30 years later, they found them. Bottles of wine, a blanket. They had were in a state of dishabille, and that's how they died. They had snuck away from the kids, you know, for a little.
Oh, what a way to go, though, in a way.
Right?
You know, like you do want to go happy. They went out. They went out together, and they went out doing what they love and what we all love. So that's good.
Of course, I don't understand. Like, I would see if you lived, I don't know, near a beach. I don't think I'd be like, hey, honey, that really freezing mountain over there looks isolated. Let's try that.
They were just role playing as Yetis, and it went wrong.
As one does. Yeah, so I prefer to stay in the bar and look out the window at the freezing,
at
you know, hypothermia level.
Have sex in Yeti costumes.
Yes, exactly.
Like, we just like to watch.
Yes, exactly. A Yeti costume would be, you know, interestingly, I think a Yeti costume would be the warmest thing to wear out there. So it would serve a dual purpose.
Oh, absolutely.
It would protect you from the elements, and it would freak people out.
Yeah.
So
I mean, $1 billion idea, guys.
Good idea.
I'm just saying, if we had like invented a snowsuit that looked like a Yeti costume, I think that would fly off the shelves.
Definitely.
It would be brilliant. Yeah. It would be warmer than any snowsuit because of all the height that you have in there too. You could even probably fit some kind of space heater in there, some kind of portable space heater, and you know, terrify people in the process.
Well, and then you have a built-in Halloween costume. You could always go as a Wookiee.
So are we splitting the profits from this endeavor three ways? Is that how that's going to work?
Oh, absolutely. Well, actually, this was inspired by Allison, so I think she should get at least, like, you know, a larger share, you know, and do like...
Oh, that's so nice of you.
I can't do the math.
Well, I'm very excited about this.
I mean, I know it's going to be a shame when you retire from writing, because, you know, that's why we're talking to you and everything, in order to just, you know, travel the world on your Yeti suit fortune.
Oh, God. You know, and that's such a wonderful thing, because you don't have to worry about ever getting writer's block or anything. It's just, I thought of a really funny costume and I became a billionaire off of it. And, you know, now I'm set. I can just write for fun.
Living the dream.
Wonderful.
Living the dream.
So speaking of monsters, I know that we ask you to come up maybe with a couple of pet peeves.
I'm actually a big reality TV show fan, which I wouldn't tell everybody, but
you're about to. I mean, all the five people that are listening to this will now know.
But I really am. I'm a huge reality TV show fan, meaning that I watch like a lot of the Real Housewives shows, and I watch The Bachelor, and there are these weird grammatical tics that really bother me on all the reality shows. And it's interesting how uniform they are. But the ones that really bother me are, first of all, everybody says "that being said." And I don't know per se whether that's bad grammar, but to me it's bad grammar. I think it should either be "that having been said" or "that said." "That being said," it's like "that is said" or some, I don't know. That really bothers me. And everybody says that on the reality shows. But the thing that really bothers me is "journey." Everything is a journey, you know, like.
Oh, I thought you meant the band.
No, well, the band bothers me too. And actually my solution for the whole journey issue, you know, I'll get to eventually, but hopefully, but everybody says that, you know, everything's a journey. Like on a lot of the Real Housewives shows, it's either, you know, somebody's sort of, you know, reshaping themselves by a plastic surgery. That could be a journey. You know, a momentary battle with Lyme disease can be a journey. Or somebody's, you know, time on The Bachelor, you know, dating people on TV is a journey, an emotional journey. And all of it really bothers me. And the word "journey" is so overused. So I think that whenever anybody says Journey on one of these shows, they should have to stop, look at the camera, and sing an entire Journey song.
But they should also have to do it on a train going anywhere.
People talk about their journey to being published, and that always sounds a bit weird. That's not a journey. That's just,
yeah,
you wrote something.
That's pretentious and annoying. It's not a journey unless you're, like, traveling. Maybe if you're going a long distance to meet with your editor, then that could be a journey, perhaps.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you know, it's just,
well,
it's,
you
really
know, we could blame Joseph Campbell for all of this, I think. I mean, the hero's journey.
We could blame Joseph Campbell for a lot of things. Yes, exactly. I think that's true. That's probably where it could come from. I mean, the whole spiritual journey, all of that. It's just an annoying word, too, if you say it over and over. And I'm sorry, and I might get hate mail for it, but an annoying band, you know? Like, just everything about it, I just don't like. I don't like the word. I think it should be abolished entirely.
But Allison, you've never been an uptown girl living in a lonely world?
No, oh, absolutely not. And isn't one of their lines, like, streetlights, people? Like, really?
Yes.
Streetlights. People, like, you can't think of anything better than that in order to describe. Yeah, there are a lot of people, mm-hmm, and a few streetlights in this town of mine. Oh, come on, you know. I mean, I admire good lyricists, and I just really do, because I could never write lyrics. You know, I've always wanted to. I wrote really bad lyrics when I was a teenager and hoped that they were good lyrics, but they weren't. But
oh, do you? Remember
never,
any of
I never.
Them? You've brought this
oh,
up
God.
Now.
No. Oh God, I don't remember them. I don't, and even if I did, I wouldn't admit to remembering them. But I can tell you one thing: that even in the biggest depths of my pretentious wannabe lyricist, horrible teenage, all black wearing life, I never came up with anything as utterly banal as streetlight people.
All right. So if that's one that you feel the lyrics are less than, what song do you really appreciate the lyrics of?
Well, I think Thunder Road by Bruce Springsteen. I cry whenever I've heard it. And it's probably like a million times now that I've heard it. I also love anything by Lou Reed, Velvet Underground. I just, because I could never write lyrics like that. I feel such an intense admiration, and I'm so moved by really, really good lyrics. Mm-hmm. And Bruce Springsteen would never say "Street Life People," you know, never.
Actually, Jay and I were having this conversation like a week ago. I grew up in a time where Bruce Springsteen, at least where I grew up and when I grew up, there was an association that I later learned was incorrect. Only a blue collar factory worker listened to mm-hmm. Bruce Springsteen, and this was the song of that people. And if you were female, if you were not growing up back east, if you were not, there was like, it was not something you would relate to, and it kind of had this association with it. And so I just grew up with that and never thought about mm-hmm. it until about, I'm gonna say, 5 years ago, when I started really listening to his music and going, this guy really wrote. And the funny thing is, I don't think that this association is any way accurate.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. When I got into Bruce Springsteen when I was in high school, but I was in high school in Southern California, and nobody was into Bruce Springsteen in Southern California, except mm-hmm. for me. And I actually used one of his quotes from the song Badlands from my senior high school quote in my yearbook, which was, "It ain't no sin to be glad you're alive." And I was actually talking to somebody really, like, just randomly, you know, met at a party, and we were talking about, you know, senior high school quotes, and this other person, like, had also quoted not that exact same line, but from that song. And if you listen to the lyrics of that song too, they're just so universal, and they're so appealing, actually, to somebody in high school who wants to sort of bust out of their town and their life and their existence and find more meaning in the world and everything else. And it really, there is something really universal to it.
You know, it's funny because we're talking about it, and Jay's the one that is absolutely nuts about Springsteen. Jay, do you want to weigh in here?
Well, I've got his lyrics tattooed on my arm. I don't know if that qualifies as nuts or not. I've just got Tramps Like Us tattooed on my arm, which leads to really interesting conversations in a bar in Glasgow. When everyone wants to know, like, do you really like Tramps? What's going on? It's like, no, it's a song.
You're just a big Chaplin fan.
I got in a fight once outside, waiting for in a queue for a taxi, because there was someone who's being really mean to a homeless guy, and I started sticking up for the homeless guy and got in a fight. And then I made the mistake of telling people at work about this. So then I went in the next day, and I got presented with like a really hastily made medal that said something like, he really does like Tramps.
And you're like, I was just talking about Bruce and Wendy. That's all.
But where I grew up, he wasn't cool at all when I was young. And I was like the cool grunge punk loving kid, into Nirvana and Green Day and
which
all of that.
I love too. I love that music too.
Yeah, totally. It was amazing.
Exactly. I love all that too. Yeah.
But it was, I mean, I was growing up in the middle of England nobody liked Springsteen in the mid-90s in the middle of England, because he was, for all of the connotations, throwing in the extra thing that he was just seen as flag-waving American, which put off everybody here. But I was just listening, thinking, well, I was growing up in a post-industrial area that had really suffered through decline, and I was listening to his songs and thinking, but this is about where I'm growing up. It's just the names are different, but the story is the same. But other people around me didn't see that. They just saw the flag.
It's interesting because so much of his music has been so misunderstood. You know, I mean, I know Ronald Reagan loved the song Born in the USA, which was that's not one of my favorite songs just musically, but it's actually very anti the way
it's subversive.
The United States treated vets. Yeah. It's about coming back to the USA as a vet and being completely shunned and not supported by your government. And in fact, you know, I know that he was not a fan of Reagan and you know, wouldn't take the praise, you know, from him at the time, and has always been pretty edgy and pretty liberal, but people, you know, a lot of times have misunderstood his lyrics because, you know, he is seen as so sort of all American and everything, which he is, but to be American is to not be blindly in love with your country. I just love him being a writer because I think he's such a great storyteller. God, Meeting Across the River, that's just such a perfect little song. And
it's,
you know,
a great crime
story. So many of them. But
yeah, it's a really good little crime story.
Yeah.
But while we are crediting him as being brilliant, we also need to remember that he is the guy who wrote Madman, Drummers, Bummers, and Indians in the Summers with a Teenage Diplomat.
Is he Satan revved up like a douche? Have we figured that out?
Yeah, it's revved up like a deuce, which is a type of engine, a car engine.
Oh, thank you. Oh,
you're
my
welcome.
God, all these years later, I'm like, what? Why is he singing about a deuce? What's going on?
So, sponsor type stuff. We've got a couple of great books to talk about from Down and Out Books that are coming out in the next couple of months.
Well, The Cost of Doing Business by Jonathan Ashley is available for pre-order now, and it will be released on January 29th. John Catlett, a misanthropic literary obsessive, is facing the loss of the only thing in the world he loves, his used bookstore. Well, aren't we all? A haven for fellow weirdos, outcasts, misunderstood geniuses, and malcontents, or a dinner party at my house, he has several other problems, the least of which are his love affair with a bipolar femme fatale heiress to a thriving Northern Steel Company, or the exponentially growing opiate habit he has developed. So please consider pre-ordering that from Down and Out Books, and it is available again on January 29th, 2018.
The next book we're going to talk about, also from our friends at Down and Out, is The Devil at Your Door by Eric Beatner, friend of the podcast and host of Writer Types, or co-host of Writer Types. I don't want to cut Steve out of existence there. That's available for pre-order and is released, I believe, on the 12th of February. So we'll have had another show out by then, but we're doing this now anyway because we're really making this up as we go. So it's a Lars and Shane novel. Lars and Shane have returned to a quiet life on the island. But for Lars, there is unfinished business. When he gets information that will lead him to exact revenge on behalf of his young protege, the young woman he's grown to think of as a daughter, he decides to take action in secret. When he lands in a hospital, Shane is called in from 1,000 miles away, and she must take the lead in the last job of Lars' storied career of death for hire. That sounds pretty good.
Ooh. I'm definitely in. So hopefully everyone listening got a huge haul of books as holiday gifts. That means you can probably spare one or two that you've already read and mail them or drop them off at a local homeless shelter. I mean, it's cold out there. Most of you are looking at snow and like -6 to 11 degrees. Books give people a reason to stay inside, and staying inside can save lives. A couple of years ago, I, with the help of a bunch of generous authors, put together a list of shelters that accept book donations. The list is in the show notes, and I would really, really appreciate it if you would pass along. There's more than likely a shelter in your neighborhood that's listed, but it's not completely comprehensive. So if there's one near you I'm missing, let me know and I'll add it.
There we go. I guess we should head back to that conversation we were having with that author type person.
The one who's the Madonna of crime fiction?
The Madonna of crime fiction. Perfect. You mentioned Lou Reed, and I think one of the his New York album is one of the biggest influences on my writing. I know when I that there's still sometimes I'll sit and listen to songs, and I'll go back and I'll listen to the album, and then I'll realize, like, I think Dirty Boulevard. Quite recently, I was listening to that and suddenly realized that Dirty Boulevard covered like about 3 books worth of my writing, was just lifted straight from that song.
Oh yeah, that's an amazing album. And actually, I just contributed to an anthology of stories based on Lou Reed songs. Lou Reed's always been my favorite, and you know, it was one of the first things I bonded with my husband on. I think like on one of our first dates, he was playing me Lou Reed songs on his guitar, which is really easy to do. It's only like a couple chords. But you know, we wanted to play Satellite of Love at our wedding, and the band didn't get it, you know, whatever. But I just contributed to an anthology that I'm not quite sure when it's coming out, but it's crime stories based on Lou Reed songs. And I wrote one based on Sister Ray. Have you ever heard that one?
Right, okay.
It's that's really a Velvet Underground song with him, but it's, you know, it's about that it's just some kind of wild party with all these drag queens and a sailor gets shot, and I don't know, it was just great fodder for a crime story. But he's an amazing, incredible storyteller too, and his lyrics are just great poetry, I think.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And some of it a little more,
I think it was his voice as well. He just got that voice of it was like someone sitting next to you telling you a story, even when it was horrible stuff. It was just like someone saying, come and sit next to me, because he'd got this just nice, relaxed, comfortable voice that just sucked you right in.
That's really true. Yeah. Yeah, and great characters on that album, too. Like, really, all of them. Romeo and Juliet's another great song on that.
Enduring songs, too, because, I mean, some of my favorite covers, you know, Sweet Jane by the Cowboy Junkies, or Satellite of Love by Porno for Pyros, like, they hold up as, even though it's a different style or a different, you know, way of expressing the song, it's equally interesting as the original.
Oh, yeah, and he encouraged that. Like, if you listen to any live Lou Reed album, he sings the words different on his songs, every live performance he does, and he makes it slightly musically different on it. I think he just got bored, you know?
Yeah.
And so, like, if you listen, there are like a million versions of Sweet Jane, like a million of them, with completely different little interludes and different lyrics and everything else, and they're all just as great as the next, you know, which is same with Satellite of Love, actually, you know?
Yeah.
So, and he probably really welcomed, you know, all these terrific covers, because those they were. You could just take these songs and make them your own and use the real basis for them and then create new sort of poetry out of them, you know, which he did himself. So
I was going to say, Sweet Jane has that great line, you know, anyone who ever had a heart wouldn't turn around and break it. And it's like it's a story in one line. It's brilliant.
I know. It's funny because people don't really think of Lou Reed as being, you know, terrifically romantic or romantically, you know, driven, but a lot of the songs really are, you know. Some of them are also really, like, really troubling. Like that song Caroline Says. Says Caroline says, when she gets off the floor, you can hit me all you want, but I don't love you anymore. I mean, it's like, it's chilling and sad and awful and says so much about the person singing it, and it's so vulnerable and dark, and, you know.
That whole album
really
is a bit of an ordeal.
Yeah, I think that's true.
I personally collect, like, one of my weird things is I collect cover songs. I have really random and a lot of cover songs. And I think that there's very little gray area in cover songs. I mean, the gray area is like the cruise ship band, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But you have the black and the white, the black part where you have something like, you know, a completely new reinterpretation that you would never have anticipated from that song. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's faithful in some way, but such a new take. And then you have the other end where it's a song that you can't possibly do anything but what the original artist intended.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
exactly.
like you have a song that's so locked in that there's no deviation. And I think those two ends are great songs.
But also, like, as far as Lou Reed covers go, David Bowie did some amazing covers of Lou Reed songs. He does a great White Light, White Heat. Mm-hmm. And he mm-hmm. does a really great Waiting for My Man, too, that are just similar but slightly different, but sort of making it his own, and it's really great.
There was a charity single over here when I was... This was back when I was a teenager. There's a thing over here, Children in Need, which is like a BBC special every other year when they, you know, it's like Comic Relief, and they do a TV special.
Uh-huh.
And they raise money for kids, and famous people do silly things. And they had mm-hmm. a charity single one year, which was a cover of Lou Reed's Perfect Day, with lots of different famous people singing different bits. And it was
that's great.
This wonderful subversive act of having that song be used as like a feel-good charity single.
Right. I mean, what about the part where it says you're going to reap just what you sow? Mm-hmm. What was that?
One of the segments was like the big boy band of the time. I think it was Boyzone. I think it was Boyzone. Mm-hmm. And for their segment on the music video, they're wrapped up in tinfoil as they sing. some music director's having
really?
Fun with that.
Oh, I really want to see this now.
Do you have a soundtrack you use when you write? Like, does each book have its own soundtrack, or are you inspired by a certain song that you listen to while you write?
It's interesting. I mean, I end up using a lot of songs in my books, you know, like just sort of like I'll have my characters listening to various songs, and it sort of tells you a little bit about who they are or maybe the time period that they're set in. For instance, What Remains of Me, you know, like there's a big part of it that takes place in 1980. And so my character listens to like a lot of Joy Division and then there's like Tom Petty's American Girl playing as they're driving up into the Hollywood Hills. And, you know, in terms of setting these scenes, like I do have a soundtrack kind of playing in my head. As far as listening to music while I'm writing, I don't do that much because I find it distracting, especially with the lyrics. I get just like taken up by the lyrics. So, occasionally I'll listen to like maybe movie soundtracks or something that's just, you know, instrumental, or I'll listen to like, you know, maybe like there was a movie on Morris Peros that came out several years ago, and it's got a great soundtrack of Spanish rap. And so it's like, it's not like I fully understand all the lyrics, so it's not that distracting to me. Mm-hmm. So occasionally I'll listen to stuff like that, but usually I'm sitting there in silence with maybe the song going through my head.
I like that they're not necessarily being played, but they're in the book.
Yeah, they're in the book because I think, you know, I mean, like all of us talking, right? You know, I mean, Jay's remembering, you know, stuff from when he was a teenager and watching people doing Lou Reed covers. I mean, I think that, you know, music is just such a touchstone for different, you know, stages in our lives. And what type of music you listen to tells you so much about the person that you are, or the character that you are. So I always like using music as sort of, you know, a setting atmosphere or setting character or telling you something about a character, you know.
I find that something I used to see in the musicians I liked, like Reed and Springsteen and Westerberg and people who've had long careers, we're seeing how mm-hmm. their relationship to their songs changed as they grew old. I mean, Springsteen's still singing songs in his 60s that he wrote in his 20s, and he's managing mm-hmm. to find... He sings them with as much conviction, and they mean as much, but they mean a different thing to him. And I'm enjoying mm-hmm, trying to find out if that happens as we write. You know, as you get 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 books in, do you find that the, you know, you take the books with you and your relationship to them changes?
Yeah, that's really kind of interesting. I mean, I'm actually kind of horrified by old books of mine. I mean, honestly, like having to reread something that I've written and that's been published is just sort of torturous to me, because I feel like I can always, I mean, you like to think that you're getting better as you get older. Like, writing is one of the few things that you do get a little better as you get older with. Yeah. And it's like, if I had to like read aloud from my first book, I think I'd just be like in some kind of horrible permanent cringe that I couldn't get out of. And, you know, people will talk to me about books that I've written in the past or like mention characters. It takes me a while to even come up with them, because I just sort of block them out of my mind as soon as I write them, and I'm like sort of on to the next thing. I guess, you know, the idea of being a writer and like having to constantly answer questions about like your first book that you wrote or reading from that first book aloud, that seems kind of horrifying to me. Maybe because I've never created anything as perfect as, say, Thunder Road. If I wrote Thunder Road, I would talk about it endlessly.
But I think that's an important part of a writer's evolution. I mean, hopefully there should be an evolution. Your first book, you know, I mentioned this in the last podcast when we had Reed Coleman on as a guest. You should not, your first book should not be the perfection. It should be your most recent book. You know, that's the best book, because you're always learning and growing. And I mean, this is going to be the first time potentially that you've been compared in this way, but one performer who feels, Madonna refuses to sing the majority of her initially famous songs on tour or in concert.
Oh my God, I love
that
you just compare me to Madonna. I'm the Madonna of crime fiction. That's
exactly
what we'll be known as from now on.
No problem. But she won't. I mean, she'll do like randomly something. I think Like a Prayer is still in her repertoire, but like she refuses to do anything from her, you know, 80s albums at all.
Yeah, you know, I think that's very smart on her part, because, you know, especially with her, because her music is so tied up in her persona, and her persona has changed and evolved as she's gotten older. So it's like, does she want to, you know, become that teeny bopper vixen that sang Like a Virgin? I mean, it's odd to be 59 and singing Like a Virgin anyway, you know? You don't want to do that. So I can totally understand that. And I think she's always been very wise about the way she's going to market herself. But I think, you know, it's interesting in terms of my books and what I've written. I mean, I always say that, like, what I like to write about is, I like to write about what scares me. So when I first came out with my first book, which was in 2005. I mean, what scared me most was the idea of like, oh, a serial killer or something like that. But, you know, since then I've had, my child has grown up and become a teenager, and I'm a good deal older and stuff like that. So the things that scare me are a lot more just sort of things that could actually happen than back then. Like the idea of not really knowing your teenager as well as you think you do. That's a big theme in my book, If I Die Tonight, that's coming out. Like, that's scarier to me than a serial killer, because it's more possible, you know? The idea of, you know, people that you love having secrets, or, you know, or letting down somebody that you love, or, you know, or making a mistake that could change the lives of all the people around you without intending to do so, taking one wrong turn, you know, things like that that are entirely possible to happen scares me so much more than any, like, you know, serial killer breaking into your house type story, which was what I used to like to write about, you know? So I think just being a different person and being an older person than I was, the stuff that's relevant to me and that's going to be scarier to me is stuff that's just more
possible,
I guess. Yeah.
I do find as I get older, it's things like I'm much more scared at the thought of upsetting people I care about than I am at, you know, actually something that's going to physically hurt me, because physical pain, who cares?
Yeah, that's really true. I mean, you know, just real basic things like that, like hurting people you care about. I mean, that's, you take that and you put a big ugly magnifying glass on it, and that is, that's a noir story. That's a piece of crime fiction right there, you know? Unintentionally hurting the people you care about. I mean,
well, I was actually having this discussion last night. I said, you know, what's the one thing that you could say to your family or your loved ones that is the one thing that could make them hate you? And that's the scariest thing. And it came out in the context of the discussion started in the context of somebody had a relative who came out at a mm-hmm. time when that was a very, very difficult thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing that, you know, that's that secret, that one secret that would come out, you know, that would change everyone's life around you forever, you know. And it, I mean, it could be something as simple as that. But what secret would you die to protect, mm-hmm. you know?
Right.
I think, you know, thank God it's, as far as coming out goes, it's a much easier thing for a lot of people to do now, but there are certain communities.
There's still places where it's
still
not
terribly
yeah.
difficult. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why people like to read crime fiction, is because it kind of mirrors a lot of the fears that we actually have, but it's something, you know, it turns it into something more horrifying, you know, like if I'm, you know, wanting to come out, or I'm afraid to come out, and I'm reading a story about someone who has an even a much darker secret than that, that they need to hide, you know, then I can relate to that character in a way. And it's a form of escapism. It's like a darker form of escapism.
Well, it's true. It's the human condition in extreme. Yeah. I'm looking at the clock. This is a wonderful discussion. I don't know if you saw on social media, we're going to be dedicating today's show to Sue Grafton, who unfortunately passed away today.
She was the most, you know, in addition to being a terrific writer and somebody who was really revolutionary for female writers, and people forget, but before Sue Grafton and Sarah Paretsky, the idea of a female PI was unheard of.
Yeah.
And she paved the way for all of us who've written series involving female PIs or strong female protagonists in general within crime fiction. I mean, she was just amazing that way. But when I met her, she was just, you know, one of the most incredibly sort of gracious people that I've ever met. Just so down to earth, asking me about my books and, you know, completely, you know, surprisingly wonderful, gracious person. And it's just such a shocking loss. And it's just terrible. He's so talented, but also just such a wonderful person.
I think New Year's Eve is very, very overrated. Unlike an overrated, underrated, rated, New Year's Eve is overrated, completely overrated.
Uh-huh.
Easter, I think, is kind of rated. Like it's you get free chocolate. It's rated exactly right.
I don't like chocolate, so I'm not down with that.
We're gonna have to discuss your whole not liking chocolate thing another time, but not right now. So, all right. What do you think is an underrated holiday?
Lincoln's birthday. Because you can leave your hat on.
Okay, so listeners, you tell us, because clearly we have no idea how to play this game. What holidays do you think, or holiday traditions? What holiday traditions do you
That's
think?
That's a better question, Jay.
Yes. This is great. This is great radio. What holiday traditions do you think are overrated? What's underrated? And what is rated exactly right? And how can they do that?
I don't know.
Neither do I.
Telepathy.
Really. They can tweet us at the Defectives Pod. I really hope that's right.
Yes, it is.
Or they can email us at crimefriction@gmail.com.
Okay, so for our second entry in the Crime Friction Short Story Club, we will be reading Arson Plus by Dashiell Hammett. The link to that is in the show notes, and we will be discussing that at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Tuesday, January 9th, with the hashtag CFSSC. So please read that and then participate in our discussion on January 9th.
And we promise to remember.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Crime Friction. Crime Friction, baby. Crime Friction.
Okay, so you've been listening to Crime Friction. This time we are going to thank the guests. And thanks to this episode's Puppy PI, Miss Creance, Rob Hart, Dan and Kate Malman, and Professor Steve Weddle.
And a really huge thank you to Allison Galen, who was last seen wearing a Bigfoot costume and running across Woodstock.
All right, guys, we're out.